Before you ask, it is dumber.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
I was gonna say, Mark and I are dads.
Yeah.
So we're gonna try really hard not to do our dad jokes. But that was one where, like, he's heard every single one.
Far from the first.
Yeah. Exactly. That's what we realized. It's like, and then at that point, if it's not original, why bother?
Right. Well, because we're dads. That's why bother.
Yeah, but even then, you think your joke is original. You know, that's yeah, the that's.
Right.
Yeah, you think you're the only one that's ever thought of it that way before.
Every dad is the first dad to pun that hard.
That's right.
So, yeah, yeah.
Welcome to How I See It with me, Mark Pratt, and
Justin Sternberg. This is a podcast that works to counter cultural polarization through thoughtful conversations. So again, thank you for being on here. It is Elias, right?
It is.
And
yeah.
Dumber.
Yes, okay. Elias Dumber. Yes. Unfortunately and fortunately.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it makes for a lot of opportunities for jokes when you introduce yourself, right?
That's right. Yeah, no one forgets my last name. That's for sure.
That's right.
So what is the most redundant joke you hear that you just kind of say, aha, that's funny, where your name is concerned? What's the most redundant one?
Well, the problem is that my parents, I often go by Eli.
Okay.
My parents called me Eli forever. But apparently, God bless them, they were not bright enough to notice that they added "is" to my first name.
Okay.
So my name in and of itself.
Eli is dumb.
Yeah.
Then
no
what?
Even at all. There's then... no... Yeah. You don't even need a punchline. It is the punchline.
There you go.
Do you have siblings?
I do. I have two brothers and an adopted sister.
Are they older? Do you have older?
No, I'm the oldest. So.
Okay. So they weren't saying you were dumber than one of your other siblings, at least.
No. Well, it's funny, like, I used to always joke that people would say, "Did you get made fun of a lot in school?" And I was like, "Yes, once per year." And we grew up in a rough and tumble part of town, so you know how it goes. But that's not really my actual way of doing life. But it's a decent quip. But people jump to the P or all the things. I mean, I've had it all. But the name itself just serves it on a silver platter.
Yeah, there you go.
That is pretty great. I admit I didn't think of that or that. That's pretty great. Eli is.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of it that perspective, but yeah.
Well, if people don't know you go by Eli, I guess they don't think about it. But, you know, when you're introduced as Eli as a kid, then you go, oh, shoot.
Well, and of course, on this end, we spent a lot of time saying, okay, how do we get to this point to clarify? So I appreciated you clarifying that right off the bat, because I'm sure you've heard it 100 times. It's like, yes, it is dumber, just for the clarification, but yes.
Yeah. Well, and my family's very English, too. So you start, like, English, Irish, Scotch, you start calling us Dume, and it's a whole, there's war to be had.
Oh, yeah, so. That's true. It is exactly what it is, That's funny.
What? I was having a conversation with a UK publication not too long ago, which was pretty funny, because Sarah Ferguson, if you remember the Weight Watchers commercials and all of that, she's from Dumber, England.
Oh wow!
This whole thing. Those of us with this ridiculous name are apparently quite proud of the Weight Watchers princess. The whole thing.
That's another claim to fame.
Yeah, we go.
Did you know that prior?
Prior to what? Having my name? No.
No. About Sarah Ferguson and that whole thing, or did you figure that out?
I, at some point, I don't know, when we were teenagers or something, my dad was like, so it turns out Fergie is from, and it was before the other Fergie came along, so that was it.
Yeah.
Neat.
Not quite, It's not quite as of a claim to fame of the new Fergie, I mean that.
No, it would be much cooler if that Fergie
that's right.
Number England, but
alas. All right, well, speaking of cool, I'd love to talk about your new album and just a few things about it.
Sure.
First of all, it's really cool that you kind of... You raised the money. I mean, I think you produced it. You did everything, right? I mean,
Well, actually, less so than on my first solo record. So, okay. City Harmonica is, of course, like signed to record label, and we did self-produce the EP with Manifesto and everything through a barter deal, which is a whole story. And then and then the rest were all record label records, and then my deal finished. So typically when you're signed to a record label, you either get dropped or you finish your deal, or you never finish your deal and you're in there for life. We had the luck of having been able to finish our deal, a couple records recouped, and I was able to go indie without it being terribly dramatic. So when the band retired, I went indie, and that was it. I mean, so we did kind of a crowdfunding campaign for both Volume 1 and Volume 2.
Yeah.
But Volume 2 was, whereas Volume 1 was a lot more like scratching all the itches that I never got to scratch in a band. Volume 2 was a little more like, okay, I'm a little more comfortable with what I want to do now. And a big part of that was working with friends. So I did co-produce the record with Brent Milligan, who's a legend. He played bass on Jesus Freak, and he like produced David Crowder Band and Torrin Wells and Colony House and all these rad projects. And then there's a lot of like collaborations on this record as well. So it's very communal, even though I did have a vision for it and a sense of what I wanted to do, and played a heavy hand in all of it. It's still very much like doing cool things with my friends, you know?
I was going to ask you about that, because, you know, a lot of songs have, you know, bylines and different artists. And I also noticed, J.J. Heller, she, I think, was in Manifesto, right, in that video? That's
Holy Wedding Day. So she did. No, it's great. She did a version of Holy Wedding Day with us years ago. We met years and years ago. Then when they moved to Nashville, we like helped them move in and hung out. So we were kind of like family friends. I'd get together, particularly with her husband, Dave, you know, pretty regularly. And so, we love them. And so it's just one of those things where it's like, hey, we need to do a thing. Let's call up our pals. And thankfully wasn't much more complicated than that. We just sorted out the details and made music. It was fun.
Yeah.
That's really cool. Yeah, I really liked seeing all the different artists you had on there. And I think you even had your son on at one point, right? Didn't he read a scripture?
Actually, no, my kids refused.
Oh, wow.
So,
that is a voiceover from Fiverr. My kids full-blown said no. I tried.
They didn't want to be part of that friends group, huh?
We love each other.
No, I hear you.
But yeah, no, my kids did not want to be on a record.
I'm sorry, I outed them.
Okay. My daughter actually sang in a couple things on the first record as source. But no, they're all very talented and awesome people, but they did not want to read Deuteronomy on my album.
Right.
There you go. Didn't want that pressure in that moment. That's all right.
What ages are your kids?
So my youngest is 6 and my oldest is 15, and we've got 5. So it's, every year and a half to 2 years through there. So we're kind of pretty got a good spread.
Yeah.
You know, we got a kid who's got a full-time job and a kid who plays Roblox like it's his job. So
there you go.
Isn't it, though?
It kind of is. Yeah. I mean, one day, maybe. Yeah.
So speaking of your kids and that kind of thing and your passion, where did that come from for you?
Music
and your family, you know, growing up in your family, you know, that kind of thing, as you shared a little bit, you know, you kind of grew up in this construction world. And so it's like, you know, there's all automatically going to be this part of us that says, okay, yeah, music is fine, but how are you going to make a living type stuff? You know, that.
Yeah. Well, so my family, my dad's like a architectural engineer of sorts. He does like infrared heating stuff for big buildings.
Sure.
But every Saturday he would be working on the house and that sort of thing. I was honestly never really part of it. My family life growing up was like, you know, I come from a broken home, my parents divorced, and it got real complicated for a while. And so when my wife and I got married pretty young, we have my aunt and uncle who had 5 kids and this great life. They'd lived in Africa for years as missionaries. They came back and he was a contractor when he came back. And so that was all pretty great. For me, like kind of home reno stuff is really just recreational and a break for the rest of my life. But you know, I think having a tight-knit family has been important to us from the get-go, honestly, partly because my family wasn't that. My brother my brother, I have a brother who has autism, and mm-hmm. you know, I have my bit of mental health stuff in my family's mm-hmm. history, and so it's just, you know, we're a couple generations away from family disasters. Let's put it that way. So,
yeah. Sure.
So mm-hmm. I think for us, it's been important to sort of, as people who want to follow Jesus in all we do, try the best we can, at least to create a community unto ourselves and have that be something good for the community. And I don't know that we're nailing it, but it's certainly been important to us all along.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And I think in a lot of ways, that's what music is. I mean, that's you're creating. And that's, it's been a good bonding tool for me and my kids. My daughter mm. sings, my son plays drums and piano. And
so cool.
It's just been fun to connect that way. So when this house is done,
yeah,
it will include a recording studio,
nice.
Which they'll all be able to mess around in. And yeah. I don't know, I never had that. So that's pretty wild.
Yeah.
That is so cool. Yeah.
So for you, when do you remember that passion coming for you personally, even before your own personal family, you know, you and your wife, kind of, how was that developed as you walked with Jesus, how was that developed for you personally?
Yeah. I mean, I grew up in the church, so I think it was more, there was a youth pastor in my life who called us to kind of really see things as more than, I suppose, cultural Christianity. Canada was... Mm. Pretty post-Christian my entire life. There
sure.
was never a point in my life where going to church was a socially convenient, normal thing to do. I mean, I'm from urban Canada, so you can imagine it's, you know, halfway to Europe. And there's quite a lot with that. So the benefit of that is you grow up going to church, at least at the time, you grew up going to church, and for the most part, the people who are darkening the doors of that church mean to be there.
Hmm.
Very little of the sort of go to church because it's Sunday. That's not a thing.
Sure.
So by high school, I had started leading worship when I was 13. So music and faith were always pretty closely connected for me. And to be honest, there was, you know, some my relationship with that youth pastor became complicated over the years. Hmm. And we could talk about that. There's actually a song on the record that. With Citizens, with Zach, who of course was part of Mars Hill out in Seattle. So we really connected over some pretty similar experiences we had in that regard. But nevertheless, the good with the bad, that guy, you know, created a great community and a great group of a culture for calling each other into living the way of Jesus and knowing and being, I mean, it was the 90s and Toronto Airport was right around the corner. So you couldn't really avoid so much of what was happening in terms of, again, with the good and the bad, renewal and all of the things that were happening in the church in our area. So it was a really fascinating time growing up. And I think it's kind of forever left an imprint on us.
No doubt. Yeah.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, when you don't see church as a social opportunity, it definitely has a different viewpoint for you growing up the way you did.
Oh, totally. And it's not that doesn't exist at all, of course. It's just it's certainly not the norm. So having been to church in the Bible Belt in the last 10 years when we were in Nashville, it is really, really different. Really, really different.
That's kind of where I was coming from. It's like it's got to, what did you notice specifically in that era?
Well, no one ever, if you meet somebody in Canada, no one says, what church do you go to?
I hear you.
That's not coming up, you know?
Yeah.
To the point where like it's, and I've actually thought this, not to get all weird about it, but I've actually thought this sort of about the way we participate in culture as Christians, because interestingly in Canada, there's a bit more of like indifference almost rather than animosity towards religion and spirituality and Christianity. And so it's a, at least at the, like the everyday person you meet in the street,
right? Sure.
It's not like they're anti-Christian. They're just like, oh, cute.
Yeah.
And then that's the end of the conversation, unless something comes up or life gets involved, you know, which it often does. But I you know, in the Bible Belt, there's a lot more of kind of a, what church do you go to? What denomination are you from? What's your grandpa do?
Yeah.
You know, all that stuff that just isn't baked in. So, like, you know, there's nobody going to church in Canada to find their next real estate listing. Like, that's not a thing. You know, I mean, maybe it is, but not with any substantial quantity.
Huh. Sure.
And that is definitely a phenomenon in Nashville.
Right.
You know?
The politician goes
to church for the 3 months leading up to his election and
all that. Right.
You know?
Yeah.
That's fascinating. I mean, you're talking about kind of some of the more, I don't know, cultural things. And I feel like a big part of this album has a lot to do with kind of some cultural shifts. But also, I feel like they're, and this could just be me reading myself into the album. Sure. Well, I guess what I'm saying is what you want, I think, as an artist, is you want people to hear themselves in the album and like kind of embrace it as if, did you write that for me kind of thing?
Right.
So I'm sure there's some of that going on, but I also feel like maybe it is what's happening on your end. I don't know. But for me, a big part of like a shift over the years is just learning what's important, what is meaningful, what actually matters to God versus doesn't. I think about watching, like, I went to a concert of the City Harmonic was there, Newsboys concert, City Harmonic.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah. Like 10 years ago almost.
Yes. Yeah. And watching you guys do Manifesto, it was amazing. I mean, it's certainly one of my top three concert experiences. I loved it. I loved it. Just so you know, I loved it. Yeah. And, a few people from our church went, including our worship leader. We ended up doing Manifesto at church many times after
awesome.
That.
Thank you, by the way.
Yeah. Oh, man. Yeah.
Yeah.
And my wife does the keys, and she nails the part. And, I wish she was here. I'd have her play it for you. And we would indulge ourselves and make you endure it. Like, yeah, people play this for me all the time. Anyway, the point is, watching those YouTube videos, remembering that experience and kind of hearing the lyrics of what you're saying, like, do we need another song? Like, you know, like there's a progression, it seems like, in your faith of, I thought what mattered was this, and now I know what matters is this. That's a progression that I've been going through, and again, maybe reading into it, but I'm curious your thoughts on that.
So that's great. So I'll probably pop the bubble a little bit and say that the City Harmonic was born from an ecumenical missions movement.
Hmm.
So the idea of being involved in social good, however you want to construe that, the idea of the church being predominantly about the good of the city and worshiping God through our entire lives holistically, that was part of our DNA the entire time. What I think I've wrestled with is what role we play. I mean, there was certainly, we were in our 20s when that, late 20s, but in our 20s when that band kind of took off.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a little bit of like vigor and naivety, I think, potentially around how much we as a band could accomplish in terms of bringing churches together around the States, to the point where we lost our shirts in 2015 on a tour designed to do exactly that. We went around and we organized pastoral roundtables, and we were hosting, you know, Lutherans and Catholics and Pentecostals at the same thing, and then trying to get them to take communion like idiots. But like, it was not total naivety, but we certainly tried to.
They don't call you dumber for nothing.
Exactly, right? Yeah.
Sorry.
You know, and it's funny because we loved it. That was great. That was well deserved too. We lost a lot of money doing it and don't regret it in the slightest.
Oh, cool.
So that was sort of baked into what we were doing. However, I think I've always had a lot of, I guess, meta-level hope, and I still do, meta-level hope in the church, and by that I mean the global Christian church doing Jesus well. I think it's just increasingly the case, or increasingly apparent, that the disconnect between what we do as public Christianity and the doing of faith as a worship leader, as a guy who writes songs, as a thinker, as a nerd, that gap is widening, not shrinking. And I think that's difficult and frustrating and difficult in my own life because it's so disenchanting. So I'm seeing so many people not disenchanting in terms of my relationship to Jesus. That's kind of what this record is about.
Yeah.
But disenchanting and seeing so many people I love and know so crushed by that gap. That they feel like the only option they have is to completely turn off their brain or to completely deconstruct. And I'm kind of like that. We need to stop that game because like there are for me, the disentangling, if you will, of a belief here or there that when you're in youth group, you're told this is what the Bible teaches. And then you read a few church history books and you go, hey, wait, that's like 80 years old. This thing that you're telling me is a non-negotiable is a in the grand scheme of Christian history, a baby belief.
Sure.
And there's so many of those that you kind of, and for us in the City Harmonic, the simple truth is that all was happening 18 years ago. So by the time the City Harmonic was already a band, we were already fish out of water in many of the circles that we were in. As obsessed with Jesus as ever in my life at this point, and then, but always sort of figuring out, hey, how do we navigate this by being faithful in our everyday? How do we navigate this by loving well and being kind? And how do we, my first attempt with, you know, our effort in the City Harmonic was maybe if we unite and make it clear that we can unite missionally around the person of Jesus and the story, message of Jesus, not just in terms of saving souls, but in terms of saving neighborhoods. If we can do this well, maybe that will, and I, you know, prior to 2016, I think that it was going, we had a lot of confidence that that was the case. And then by the time the band ended, it was clear that things were getting very divided in culture and that sort of thing. And I think that's all escalated all of this to the point where now I'm kind of like, hey, you know what? Don't have to throw out the baby with the bathwater.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, like you've got Amos, I remain haunted and people argue about the interpretation of this, but I remain haunted by Amos 5. I mean, there's this sense in which we have.
Aren't we all haunted by Amos 5?
But I mean, like this away the noise of your festival, like away with all of these things, but let justice and righteousness, like this is kind of like sense of like, hey, you can do church all you want, but if church doesn't lead to the bottom line of your neighborhood being, you know, a better place to live.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes.
And you're wasting my time and yours. And this is, you know, the Lord speaking prophetically through Amos.
Yeah.
And so you have true religion and James, you've got all this stuff. And so I think there is this the business of doing church. And something I've kind of tried to offset. I mean, I've been a tent maker the whole time. And in that I own a marketing agency and a few small businesses in order for me to do music and ministry as earnestly as I can. You know, I tried my best to take money off the table because of my own personality, not the role. And so I, you know, we're not rolling in it, but we have at least we're able to participate in this by conviction. And that's been something I've kind of tried to foster to the best of my ability. But yeah, all of that to say, like, I think for me, there really is the like doing of religion and then the way of Jesus. It's not religion. It is religion, but it's doing that in every sphere of life is what we're called to, plain and simple.
Yeah, that's good.
That authenticity that basically goes through whatever my tent making role might be, whatever my
denomination,
whatever my service might be to the kingdom, as we may say. Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah. No, I appreciate that.
Also, while you're talking too, is so a big purpose behind our podcast here and is this idea of taking two polarized concepts. And the problem we recognize from the very beginning is we're not very polarized, so it can only go so far. But that is, oh, the video froze.
It was that drink of water we figured on this end.
That's right. So you were saying, what were you saying, Mark?
All right.
We were talking about authenticity. And then Justin was basically sharing the concept of the podcast is, you know, we're not that polar opposite in some ways, but yet our desire is to create this
room for conversation.
Yeah.
Right. Right. And so right. Yeah. I think.
Are you guys recording, by the way? I don't see it.
Yes. Not in Zoom. I'm recording via OBS.
Got it. So. Okay. Sweet.
Thank you for asking.
But yeah, thank you.
Appreciate it.
Yeah. We've been known to record a lot of things and not get it down. So that's our
record.
Yeah.
Yes. That's great.
Yeah. Back to polarization.
Yeah. Big reason for the podcast is we really want to start having conversations with people who, take this idea where you're over there and you belong over there and I belong over here and we throw things back and forth at each other. And that applies across politics, that applies across denominations, that applies with the theological beliefs, whether you believe in predestination, God's sovereignty versus, you know what I'm saying? Like, there's so many things, and culturally...
The facets, if you will.
Yeah.
The little things that we know about people that keep us from having the larger conversation.
Totally. Well, and it's hard because in some ways our brains work against us in this regard, right? Like there's a lot. I mean, I'm a big nerd, so I'm not a scientist, but neuroscience has been a long interest of mine.
Mm.
Sociology and behavioral economics, both interests of mine. So it's sort of one of those things where it's like you learn enough about how people choose to do things and what they choose to do in life, and you go, oh darn, like the deck is stacked against us in a sense. There's this marketing guru named Seth Godin. I don't know if you've heard.
Yeah.
He has this phrase that kind of boils down so much human behavior. And it's people like us do things like this. Mm-hmm. And so like at the end of the day, you can pretty accurately predict what a group of people will do if you know what their us is and you know what they think that us is supposed to do.
Sure.
And it's kind of fascinating in a sense. Like I feel like, at least in theory, once upon a time, that us was, hey, we're Christians belonging to the church and belonging to Jesus. And that's how we define our us. So when we approach politics, when we approach municipal issues, when we approach our neighbor, we're approaching as I'm a Christian and a Christian is like. Mm-hmm. And it feels like that. I mean, Kuiper was talking about this 100 years ago, but it feels like that first us, that first tribal first principle, right, has sort of been replaced by other things, whether it's politics or personal identity or some other allegiance. Mm. And Christianity's in there, but it's in there in the soup as opposed to in there as the bowl. Sure. And I think that's really heartbreaking. And I feel like it's a total miss in the church for us to not be really calling people to say, hey, first and foremost, the way of life revealed in the person of Jesus and empowered by the Spirit and in Christ is the first principle from which we go out into the world. And so like, even when we were doing unity work, trying to get people from very different denominations to work together, we found centering on the creeds, like the simplest Christian list, to at least kind of get the, like, where do we differ off the table? It's like, hey, look, if this is what the church has always said is the list, we're going to use that list so that we can set this topic aside and go do work together.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what Manifesto was, actually. Mm-hmm. That it was creeds.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So good. I mean, in one of your songs, you say, we're looking for a prophet to teach you, a shepherd to lead you, a king to believe in. But isn't that Jesus? And yeah. I mean, it's kind of speaking to what you're saying. Well, we're always
looking towards,
as humans, we tend to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And we take our eyes off of the true king and the true kingdom, and we start to replace it with proxies, right? Like, oh, Jesus, Republican, right? Or
right.
Baptist. And this is now Jesus. And that, but this is easier to see. This is easier to wrap my mind around. This is easier to have an allegiance to. But we still call it the kingdom, right?
Oh, totally. Well, and I think behind that too, there's a not to get all heady about it, but there's a healthy degree in which I feel like in Western Christianity, and I only speak it that way because I don't know present day Eastern Christianity well enough. But
sure.
Within our context, it feels like there's a dualism that has been taken for granted, where we think of the gospel, we think of the Christian faith
and the implications of the Christian faith as being primarily spiritual and having little or nothing to do with real life.
Mm. Right.
Sure.
Yes.
So the implications of knowing Jesus and having the Holy Spirit are a bunch of esoteric spiritual exercises and or experiences, and that it's primarily about escaping. And
sure.
I don't see that in the Bible. I don't see that in the Christian story up to you know, the last, up until maybe 150 years ago. Mm. And so there is this sense in which, like, no, the Jewish people were a deeply holistic people. They weren't primarily concerned about the afterlife. They didn't even barely have a theory of the afterlife. Mm-hmm. So most of the Old Testament, they're all over the place in terms of what happens after you die. So it seems clear to me, at least, that that wasn't the primary concern of Jesus as he called his disciples. And, you know, so much of the New Testament is about how do you live now? Yes. How do you live?
Yeah.
And that's I think we've kind of lost a lot of that as the main thrust of what is happening. And so if that's the case, then I think it kind of makes sense that people are going to turn to other things to say, well, if Christianity doesn't answer how I should really live, because there are reasons I shouldn't take this teaching or that teaching seriously, then I'm going to look to something else to tell me how I do live, because I do have to go to work.
Yeah.
I do have to go to the grocery store, and I do have to. So we kind of need to redeem a little bit. Yeah. Of that, like, this is a way. This is the early churches, early Christians were called the way. Mm-hmm. We're following in the footsteps of Jesus. The red letters in the Sermon on the Mount are instructive.
Yeah.
Not, you know, and really take that to heart. It feels a little bit like a voice in the wilderness in our current political climate.
But. To your point about all of that, We're pretty involved. I've been involved in a program called Celebrate Recovery for 15 years, and Mark's been involved for a few years with me, and we love it. And a big reason I love it so much is because it's basically saying, this problem of addiction, there is a solution, and it's Jesus, right? And it's basically it's what you're saying. It's taking all of these scriptural truths and saying, now apply it for real here, and apply it for real here, and apply it for real here, and then holding you accountable to that and living in the reality of what it is to be a Jesus follower who struggles, because all Jesus followers struggle. Totally. You know what I mean? And Jesus's teachings are full of how to live as a broken person, but trying to follow him, you know? And it's not hard to find tools in the Bible for addiction, it is. So it's been a passion of mine for a long time, because it's kind of putting boots to the ground in terms of what Jesus said versus practical living things out. Does that make sense?
Oh, totally. Well, and I think with that, like you mentioned the song Kyrie Eleison, It's Mercy We Need. So I wrote that with Zach Boland of Citizens, and so Citizens features on the song. And of course, that was in response both to my own experiences and his in Mars Hill with Mark Driscoll. So we wrote that song before the Rise and Fall of Mars Hill podcast even came out. My experience had nothing to do with cameras and podcasts, but my youth pastor had similar personality traits. And the reality is, looking back, there is good and bad in that experience and relationship. I don't want to throw them under the bus. It's not that simple. But the reason that the song, the kind of pretense of the song is it's mercy we need, is realizing that on some level, like, personality worship in and of, if we throw all of our eggs in the basket of a human being, that human being will fail us. There's exactly one who hasn't. And you know, I think there's, and I had the gift of having that man in my life saying all along, don't follow me as I follow Jesus, quoting Paul, of course.
Sure.
So there is this sense in which, like, we do need that. We need the social interaction. We need that trust to be meaningful. Like, if in Celebrate Recovery, everyone around you failed all of the time and no one actually accomplished what they were trying to do, it wouldn't be a very effective ministry,
right?
And so it's the same thing. Like, yes, we fail, but we are constantly pulling each other forward because we exist in a community while redirecting. And that's a kind of a two-sided thing that we have to do. And I think we so love personality worship as people were drawn to that. And so that I think there's a reason that at the heart of it all, Jesus essentially calls us to mercy and kindness in the story of the Good Samaritan, in breaking it all down to the Shema and loving God and neighbor, basically the same. There's this sort of like, hey, well, what does kindness mean? Kindness is treating of like kind, right? So there's this sort of like, hey, at the heart of the Christian message is a love that surpasses our failures and surpasses our dividing lines and surpasses our boundaries. And that includes not holding someone up in a place that they can't possibly live up to.
Sure. And it's interesting as you think about that. I think that's what the Sermon on the Mount was. You have been taught, you know, the Pharisees have demonstrated, you know, but I'm showing you, I'm telling you, this is what the kingdom is about, you know? And I think,
totally.
And I think that's what we're talking about, you know, so much of what we believe or tend to think about, we have been taught by someone, you know, who we've held in esteem, whether it's our parents, whether it's a worship leader, whether it's a youth pastor, those kind of things. And it is about that relearning based on, you know, Jesus wanting or deserving even, and being able to extend that mercy to others and to ourselves to say, okay, yeah, this is what you've learned. This is what you've been taught. So it makes perfect sense that you're operating in this way.
Because people like us. Yeah,
that's exactly it.
Yeah.
People like us do things like that, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Right. That's right. Yes. And I mean, Christianity is 2,000 years old and as diverse as every nation on the planet. And I'm talking about like basic Orthodox Christianity, not even talking about, you know, all of the various splinter cults that might break off. I mean, like within the confines of genuine, authentic Christian faith, we have a lot of history and a lot of diversity. And so I think, you know, just because someone failed me horribly, and they did, and just because someone bordered on abuse, and I don't know, but you know, it certainly gets close. And so like, just because those things happen doesn't mean that Jesus isn't who he says he is. Sure. It means that I've got work to do in understanding and unearthing, in a sense, through history and these ancient writers and current writers, and going, what is it? What's the diamond in the center of all of this coal that just keeps shining through no matter what? And that's, you know, we've talked about this record as like stubbornly hopeful, because that's kind of it. Like, it's not a deconstruction record, so to speak, because if you wanted to describe my spiritual life, that would have happened 20 years ago. And it did, in a sense, like trying to figure out what's this or what's that in faith. That's a journey I'm still on. But it certainly is a like, hey, I've been as frustrated and angry, and it's like lament and hope in the same place. We started this record, Brent and I, when we were first talking about it, I was like, I really feel like if I make anything right now, first of all, it was approached as an album, so I appreciated that you listened to it as such, but it was meant to be a journey from start to finish, lyrically, musically, all of it. And so it was sort of this sense in like, I feel like it would be really hard to put out a worship record right now, or any record that's designed to help people pray prayers through music, and have it not be at least bittersweet.
Yeah.
I don't know how someone living in North America or the West can look at our life as the church right now and not be like, well, this is complicated.
Right.
I mean, we've got a lot of people angry about a lot of things, and for good reasons. And so I think it, as those of us helping people process that through music and prayer, I just can't imagine having made a record that was, you know, rainbow and sunshines and high fives and unicorns. I just don't see it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And those albums certainly exist, but they're kind of disjointed, right? From
it certainly feels like it, but it makes sense if your Christianity is totally divorced from your real life.
Yeah,
that's the place where you go to happy. That's where you go to escape the real world instead of
unicorns, like you said. That's where you go to get them.
You do that, and then you walk into your everyday life going rainbows and unicorns, rainbows. It's like, well,
can you please?
It doesn't seem. My kids already did, I'm sure.
It was
good. I love, you know, because you're saying without you, it's smoke and mirrors, only noise. But, and that's where that hope comes in. And when I when I listen to that song and so much of the album, there's just so many moments where it's like, I'm with you in that pain, but there's always a but, because he doesn't need us culturally to be something. He's going to be what he's going to be with or without us. So when he does show up, it doesn't matter how wrong we're doing it, right? And so there's something about that for me that's recognized. I'll never do it perfect, because me and my wife, we lead worship at CR. And so there's so many days where I get in my way, in God's way. And I'm like, you know what? I can't fix that 100%. I can work at it and I can repent. Ultimately, what I really need is I need you to do what you did last week. Because that wasn't me, you know what I mean? And so, and there's so many moments where it's, he shows up and you go, ha! Well, that's not me, so I hope you guys are enjoying this. I am, you know, and there's that hope that comes when he does what he does. So I love that balance, you know?
Yeah, well, and it's. I think so much of real human life is lived in that tension. It's in the space in between hurt and brokenness and difficulty and all of that, and the ideal good that we know is there. Like we see through a glass darkly, right? But I think there's really something to be said for the beauty of the smallness of what you're talking about in CR.
Yeah. Agreed.
Like and there's I think part of why we are so drawn to the idea of mega movements is because they cost us nothing. So easy to wave a flag of belonging to something and maybe give my 5% or 2% or whatever the statistics are and be like, oh, I'm doing this thing here without having to worry about what Fred next door is doing or whether I'm kind to him regardless of his choices in life, you know, whether I show him love.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's one of the shocking things about the Sermon on the Mount. I mean, Jesus is sitting there telling an occupied people, like violently occupied, to love their enemy and carry their bag an extra mile. Now, there are layers to that. That's a nuanced and complicated instruction, but it is also a simple instruction. The simple part of it doesn't change. And I think we've gotten to the point where we've turned our various isms into just another flag that we wave because it's so much easier than doing it. But you go to CR and you're part of this small thing. You're looking that person in the face. I mean, I remember I used to run an alpha group at years and years ago. I was sort of running it with my friend at a shelter, like a rehab.
Oh, cool.
So we were doing alpha and leading worship in that same way with guys who were sharing just heartbreaking stories of the cards real life had dealt them. And it's funny, you know, few years later, I'm on a tour bus touring the world and fly into so-and-so. And I love all of that. I'm not saying it isn't a blast because it is.
Yeah,
sure.
But you, I don't know if it's age or what, but you go and you're like, both of those things are good, but one of these things changes the world in 300 years.
Yeah.
And another one of them seems to kind of break every 10.
See, this is what I'm talking about. What I hear in your album is what you're saying, like you toured the world, you played in front of whatever stadiums, auditoriums, and there was a certain amount of impact and significance to that that I think you probably experienced. I would hope, right? Where it's is amazing.
I feel like it mattered. I don't, but it did.
Right. At the same time, you get further along in your life, you've had enough one-on-one counseling sessions, or you heard someone's story come from a broken place and you're like, this thing matters more than all of that. Is like,
or heck, I've had to go to therapy myself. I mean, there's all of that. Like there's enough real life as you get on, and my kids are teenagers. And so my own failings, and I don't mean my kids' failings. I mean my own failings as a parent stare me in the face every day, where they're like, "Hey, you're not all you want to be cracked up to be," and I'm like, "That's totally fair."
Yeah,
you know. So I think there's something as you get older where you just go, you know, I'm as earnest as I ever was. I think probably more earnest. I'm less afraid of losing influence or you know, something like that, because I'm just like, you know, at the end of the day, you need to know who your friends are, you need to know who your people are, you need to know what's important to you, and try your darndest to do it empowered by the Spirit. I would love at this point, I'm hoping for my kids' adulthood, them thinking, you know what, Dad wasn't perfect, but he gave it a solid go.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, same.
Yeah, same. No doubt.
That would be okay by me. That's a successful run. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I feel the same way.
Yeah.
It's interesting. I love hearing a perspective from someone like you who has toured and done those things. And has kind of come back to this place of, you know what probably matters more than that stadium room. God could have done something in any one of those stadiums, and that is, you know, like, of course. But recognizing that I could walk across the street and talk to my neighbor, and the 300 years from now, that could have a bigger impact, right? You're saying.
Oh, yeah. Well, like last night, my wife and I are walking. This is not to say I'm some kind of hero. Far from it. My wife was the hero in this scenario. Hamilton is a rough city, so we're walking, you know, from our parking spot to the theater where we went to see a musical. And two homeless guys, younger guy, both on something. And the younger guy's just beating the snot out of the older guy. And my wife jumps in and says, "Hey, what are you guys doing? It's okay. You got to stop." And I'm jumping in the same way. And it dawned on me. So the guy comes right up to us, is talking, and we called the police shortly afterwards. It's just this like little, like, I could have not done any of that.
Yeah.
I could have done more than I did. I could have done a lot less.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like those little choices. We encounter them all of the time.
Right.
All of the time.
Right.
And that has nothing at all to do with, you know, my guitar amp.
Yeah.
Like there's nothing to do with it. That's not to say that's not meaningful.
Right.
Those moments together, that sort of fuels the rest of it. But it isn't the point at all. And so that you kind of get this, like, Jesus is saying, hey, the crowds aren't evil. It's not like and we have a tendency to kind of go black or white in this.
Yes,
it's like,
oh,
sure,
it's all about small groups and home church. Well, problem is the early church went to the temple too. So you kind of have this, history doesn't agree with it's all about home church.
Sure.
And then you have this kind of, it's all about the big meeting. Well, that doesn't work either, because all of the instructions we have are about lived life. And so you have this kind of tension. I think this, and we want it to be a very simple answer. And Jesus gives us that. He says the first principle of Christianity is love the Lord your God in every domain in your life. And just like that, love your neighbor.
Sure. Right?
And that's it. That's you want a simple version of Christianity.
Yeah.
It's there.
Yeah.
And it isn't win at a political issue. It isn't power at all costs. In fact, if anything, it looks like the opposite of power at all costs. But, like, you know, it's kind of this pursue these two things. And I think there's a role to be played in podcasts and concerts and albums and all of that. But for the longest time, I concerned myself in music with what sort of music it was I was writing. Was it congregational worship music or not? And that sort of thing. And I think on this record, I've become a little more comfortable with the idea that there's a little bit of that on the record. There's probably three or four songs that would make great worship songs at church. But a lot of what I do is for the rest of the week.
Sure.
You know, and it's not really for the purposes of entertainment, although it is entertaining, hopefully, but it's really like me processing my following good and bad out loud in the hopes of giving somebody else the ability to, whether it's on their run or their morning walk or whatever, you know, to do the same thing and have language that they didn't have to do that. That's kind of what we do as worship writers, you know?
Yeah.
So this record does have a bit more of like an artistic and I don't know, vulnerable flair to it. than Worship Records can, and certainly than I've been able to produce at different times. So, yeah.
No, and like you say, I'm definitely not steeped in worship nearly as much as Justin is. And that's a compliment, you know, to have that being so much of your life. You know, you're immersed in it to a degree, and that's a great thing. But it was definitely for me, you know, from the outside listening to your album, I appreciated the way, I guess my wife and I, whenever we go somewhere to worship, you know, corporately, you know, we just appreciate so much when there is a vocabulary that draws us, you know, towards Christ and who God is versus the me worship style that, you know, repeats what I am and how God can help me versus how me focusing on God and drawing close to Him transforms me. Mm. And, you know, and I think so much of that is that difference between entertainment and worship. You know, and I think that becomes, you know, there again, there's that tension.
That's what I was going to say is, like, I think the reality is, though, that's a tension. So what often worship leaders will do is make that into a hard and fast rule.
Yeah.
They'll say, oh, I can't write a song with personal pronouns in it. It all has to be talking to God. The problem is the vast majority of Christian history used the Psalter as the worship book of the ages.
Sure.
And, you know, were we to make that a hard and fast rule, we only talk to God, never about ourselves. Mm-hmm. We don't celebrate anything God has done for us. We only celebrate who God is. You'd fail the Bible.
Yeah.
So if the songbook of the Bible can't pass that rule, it's a good reminder.
Sure.
That rule.
No
and
doubt.
That's kind of the thing that tension is there. And worship leaders are so often drawn to the simplest version of it so they can move on.
Hmm. Sure.
And I think that's something that I don't think following Jesus allows us to do very easily is move on to the next thing we can be victorious over.
Doesn't it,
what Eugene Peterson called it a long walk in the same direction, right? So sure, it's that kind of, so much of Christian faith is showing up again, like CR.
Sure.
It's showing up again.
Yeah.
And being like, hey, today, this is what it means for me to be faithful in this. And so that's part of one of the dilemmas in kind of, I'm not calling anyone in particular out, but this occasional tendency to, like, almost like a toxic positivity in worship. Like the only songs we sing are victorious over all of our problems and Jericho's walls fell down. And it's just like, sometimes the wall's just still there.
But there's also this other side where it's all about the drama and how hard life is, and Jesus can get you through. But it's still it's focused on the difficult. It's kind of the opposite of what you're saying. Focused on positivity, or whatever. There's also a focus on negativity, and those draw me in more than the positivity ones. Those tie into my struggle with mental health and different things, and those can. And it is a tension. It is a balance because sometimes that's what I need to hear. I need someone to meet me where I am, right? Yes. And same with the
somewhere. Yep.
Yeah. They both are needed. I think this is a conversation I had recently with my wife too about denominations and different churches, and I think you and I talked about it too is there's a reason there's a Baptist church and our church and this other Baptist church all within 5 miles, and it's because God said it was supposed to be that way. He wanted this person here and this person here and this person here because that's what they needed. That in His sovereignty and His wisdom chose it. And I think that's true with music. I think that's true with so many things. And one of the things we've figured out with polarization in these conversations is that's the easy part, is saying, oh, I'm black or I'm white. And problem solving, like you said, now I can move on to the next problem. When it's as believers, like you said, if we're doing number one and number two right, love God, love people, oftentimes those things take us away from that, you know, because...
Yeah, well, and there's a couple of fascinating things, I think, with that. First, there's a few studies called Dunbar's Number, which has come out, which is talking about how much the brain's capacity for community size. You heard of this?
No.
So this is a study that's been debated, and the thing is, everyone comes to a number, and that number is never 1,000. Let me just put it that way. So Dunbar's first theory was 125.
Okay.
So the brain basically has capacity for around 125, you know,
connectors.
Where we can remember community connectors. And of that, we have 15 that dictate 90% of our life and time. And of that, we have like 3 to 5, which dictate 90% of that. So it's like you have a small group of people, which are relationships you can count on one hand, who are the real people. Then you have about 15 people that are your wider circle. And then you have about 125 people. And no matter what else you're doing, that's about what you have in terms of meaningful relationships. And that kind of rings true for most people, I think. There's sort of this sense of like, yeah, I guess there might be contextual relationships. There might be. But if someone at the end of their life is, you know, very few funerals have 1,000 people at them. And so like there's this kind of bonded thing. And I think like we tend to think larger than that while still doing small in that sense, right? Like we still do that 125 people thing. So it's no surprise that humans organize and divide. The question is, when you have that thing happening, is there a layer above it which we recognize as bonding us and binding us together? And so that's like, yes, you have the Methodist Church, you have the Baptist Church, you have the Catholic Church, you have whatever Anglican Church down the road. The question is, do we all say, and we have Jesus in common, and approach each other as brothers and sisters on mission together as a result of that? And I think that's a really important facet that I'm grateful to have grown up in a city where that was the norm. And that's a very rare thing. And I'll be honest, today, it feels like it's a struggle to keep in Hamilton. It feels different than it did. It's hitting less hard than it did, as far as I can tell. But it's still, that desire is still there because we've seen it firsthand here. So there is that there. I think with the music thing too, there's, and I kind of get it from a songwriting standpoint. You've got a group of people, you've got a community of people, and you got 100, let's say you're at a small church of 100, you're at a big church of 600, doesn't really matter, right? You're at a church of 10,000, I don't know. And you want everyone to come in to Sunday morning and relate to something so that they can be invested and be fully holistically invested in what's happening together in corporate worship. So that's a good goal, it's a noble goal. And so I think that naively what sometimes happens is writers and songwriters and worship leaders or pastors will say, okay, what we need to do is use averaging language. We need to use the stuff that is safely universal. But the problem is that that's often dehumanizing. We take the things that people can actually relate to out of it, and we give them almost nothing to relate
platitudes.
To. You know? Yeah, platitudes, right. Whereas, like, you know, the studies are showing, for example, that people who are angry find angry music more cathartic and more therapeutic than calming music.
Yeah.
That, you know, listening to Muzak and elevator music when you're angry makes you more angry, you know? So there is something to like, everyone, you don't need to have been to New York to hear a song about New York and get it. There's something in like, oh,
that's
I have
good.
A street just like that. And there's a city just, I can relate to that specific experience. I mean, it's Psalm 2 before Zion, which is a very particular, is mentioned. Like, the Psalms don't dodge the specific.
Sure.
You know, and it's often those specific things that we grab. And so as you're talking about like humanity and music and feeling like, hey, I often gravitate towards the stuff that seems hurtful, avoiding that stuff actually doesn't make that stuff go away.
Right.
And if anything, it actually makes people feel like the gap and divorce between the Christian life and what it's required to participate in the Christian life and their real life is wider and wider and wider and wider.
Sure.
Because now they're not allowed to have any negative emotions in the process.
Yeah.
And we all have.
Yeah.
So I think there's really, I don't know that I'm succeeding, but I'm certainly trying my best to go, hey, look, I'm going to try to more and more write vulnerable, honest, human worship songs.
Sure.
And I hope that that calls us to more. I hope that that calls us to Christ-like living. But I don't read scriptures. I don't read Paul. I don't read David and Jesus and see at the end of that we're called to deny being human through it.
Yeah.
Is that what the Psalms are about, really? When you stop and think about it, the diversity.
Yeah.
One chapter, it's like, God, you're the only thing. And then the next, it's like, God, how'd you do this? You know?
And also like, how many heads can I chop off? Like,
yeah.
That's,
yeah.
Psalms is all over the place.
Yes, exactly.
It is.
And it is just the case that our songbooks aren't now.
Yeah.
Psalms is not neutered, to your point. No, like, it is very raw, very visceral. And in all of David's life.
Isn't that what made him a man after God's own heart, was that authenticity that we're actually talking about? Is that ability to say, okay, God, this is where I'm at, but you know that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Hey, thank you for listening to our podcast. If you like How I See It, please do all the things that podcasts tell you to do. Subscribe, rate, review, follow us, and or talk nicely about us on social media. If you want to reach out, the email is us@howiseeit.click. Yep, I said dot click, as in dot C-L-I-C-K. Please tell your friends about this show, and we'll see you on the next one.